The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Andrea, for those of you who have not met before, I've been away for a while, and I'm actually going away again, so I'm back this week, and I'll be away again for the next few weeks. But there will be somebody here, so always somebody here to hold this space this evening. So I've been interested lately in exploring this dynamic or this edge around how what the Buddha had to say nearly 2,600 years ago is relevant for us in this time. And I think it's incredibly relevant. I mean, what the Buddha, I think, really did was to do a deep dive into how our minds work. How is it that we struggle? And this was his whole search, was why? Why do human beings suffer? Why do human beings struggle? And so he sat down and started looking at his mind and began to understand through that. Kind of, I think, you know, as he looked at his own mind, it wasn't just that he was trying to understand his own mind, he was trying to understand the human mind. And with that perspective, he began to see so many different patterns, habits, ways that the mind functions that he understood weren't just about him, but were really reflective of how human minds work. And as he understood that, understood how our minds create suffering, as he deeply entered into that understanding, what I understand is that understanding of how suffering works created the conditions for a release from suffering. And so the very understanding of how these patterns work supports us for finding our way free from them. And so that works now, just as I think it worked then. And also, you know, the way that the human mind does what it does, actually, we haven't changed that much in 2,600 years. Sure, the devices and the events of the world, those things change, but the kind of patterns of how we relate to things, it's repeatable. It's repeating itself over and over again. In small ways, in large ways, the same kind of patterns repeat themselves over and over again. There's one particular pattern that the Buddha described for the creation of suffering that I'd like to explore with you tonight. It's a very fundamental teaching of the Buddha, but it's actually not one I talk about much in a community setting because it's a pretty complex teaching. But I've been exploring finding ways to make it accessible and relevant. For me, it's definitely a relevant teaching of understanding, okay, how does my mind get caught in the patterns that it gets caught in? So the name of this teaching, it kind of has a scary name, dependent co-arising or dependent origination, something like that. And it basically is the Buddha's elaboration of how our minds get caught. There are 12 links in this description. He parsed it apart and found these 12 steps. Some of these are arising together. They do actually arise together, but they also condition each other. And so it's like it's a description of the conditions that lead our minds into struggle. And so I'd like to explore this with you. And first of all, I'll give you some whys. Why talk about this teaching? Because it may sound a little bit like an intellectual teaching, but partly it really is a description. The Buddha is describing in this teaching how our minds typically work, when they're kind of motivated by their typical habits and patterns. And so it's useful for us to begin to recognize this. Partly, it's a very clear description of how suffering comes to be, of how dissatisfaction comes to be, of how unease comes to be, of how struggle comes to be. Where this suffering is a big word, and often we apply it to the big kind of struggles in our lives. But this pattern that he's describing applies to the little, oh, I don't like that very much. Why does it have to be that way? You know, just the little grinchy kind of offness of our lives. It applies to that as well as to the really challenging things that we meet. The patterns we see in our culture right now, the political divisions, all of that, and our relationship to them. And I think partly because this pattern describes how a human mind works, and what's happening in our culture is a bunch of human minds bumping up against each other. And so I think this teaching also has something to say about that. How do we kind of bump up against each other? Where does that come into play here? And so it's a very clear description of how our human mind tends to get caught and tends to struggle. Partly because it's a description that we can begin to see and kind of begin to recognize ourselves in. As I go through it, I think you will recognize your mind. And for me, as I heard this teaching and began recognizing my mind in this description, it's like, oh my gosh, this isn't just me. This is like, the Buddha said, the Buddha described this 2,600 years ago. And this is like, this is the way a human mind works. So it kind of takes some of the sting, the personal sting, out of the way our minds get caught. It's like, oh, right, this isn't just my fault. In fact, it's not my fault that I'm struggling or suffering. It's the nature of human minds to get caught in these kinds of patterns. And so, to some extent, I think hearing this teaching, hearing the Buddha lay this out and begin to recognize, yep, wow, my mind does that. We kind of begin to recognize that this is not a personal condition. So it takes some of the tightness perhaps out of it. And maybe we can begin to be interested in looking at our minds, looking at how our suffering happens, rather than judging ourselves and telling ourselves, well, I must be a horrible person because this is what my mind does. This is what human minds do. And the good news, too, embedded in this teaching is that, yes, this is what human minds tend to do when they're caught by habitual patterns, when they're caught by ignorance, basically. This is the ignorance of how suffering comes to be is kind of the foundational link in this chain. When we don't understand how suffering comes to be, our minds tend to think they're going to find happiness in certain places and ways, and we go off doing that. And what that actually ends up doing is putting us on this cycle, searching for happiness in places that it can't ultimately be found. And so as we see this pattern, the understanding, as has happened for the Buddha, the understanding begins to release us from this pattern. So in this case, knowledge is good news. It doesn't feel good at times to see this pattern at work, but seeing it at work and understanding that it is a human pattern at work is very different from being caught in this pattern of suffering at work and just being kind of haplessly, helplessly driven by it. So it really can help us to understand this pattern. The other piece about this particular teaching is that it points to, as I said, there are 12 parts to this chain, and it and I'll name them in just a moment. And it points to how each one conditions the next. I'll mention them now. Ignorance, where I said this starts, the ignorance of basically not understanding how suffering arises, conditions what's called mental formations or habits and patterns of mind that want to find a way to happiness, but that wanting to find a way to happiness is based in ignorance. So ignorance conditions these mental formations, these habits and patterns. And these habits and patterns then condition our consciousness and our bodies and minds to be looking in certain places and doing certain things. Now, those are the next two links. Ignorance conditions mental formations, conditions consciousness, conditions body and mind processes. And those, because we have a body and mind, then we have these sense bases where we're impinged on then by, so there's these sense bases in our body and mind, the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the skin, and the mind is a sense base in the Buddhist understanding. So six sense bases, the five usual ones we talk about in grade school, and the sense base of the mind, which is basically the mind that receives... the mind is a base in much the same way the eye is a base, and the eye is a sense base in that it receives sight. The mind is a base in that it receives thoughts and emotions, things like that. And so there's that place of contact in the mind. We have this these senses, and because we have these senses, we are impinged on. There's contact with the world. Based on contact, there's feeling. Feeling of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Based on feeling, there tends to be a craving, a moving in a direction towards or away. Based on that craving, that moving towards or away, we tend to orient and say, I want this, I'm going to have this. So the wanting and the grabbing onto, that's clinging, craving and clinging. And then there are kind of identities and ideas that get born out of that craving and that clinging. Is I'm the person that can control things and do things, and I can make this happen. That's called becoming. And then there's a birth into a full-blown identity of I can do this. This is who I am. And from here, the next link in the chain is basically suffering. Aging and death is the term there. And this... So this link, this set of links, which I will go through in a bit more detail here, just to kind of give you a flavor of each of these, it's got a kind of a cyclic nature in a way, because when we come to that suffering at the end of the chain, that there's a teaching in that the Buddha offered or is in the teachings that he said, when we suffer, that tends to either lead us towards ignorance, towards confusion, towards bewilderment. Why me? What's wrong with me? What did I do wrong? Or it leads us to search. Does somebody know a way or two out of this suffering? So it tends to lead us, that if when we don't meet a teaching that points us to a different way to relate to our experience, the encounter with suffering tends to lead us back to more confusion. I must have done it wrong. What I've learned is, you know, I get what I want. I'm gonna try again. I'll figure this out. I'm gonna control things. I'm gonna fix things. And so the notion of suffering is just fed back into this cycle. And so it has a kind of a cyclic nature in a way. So suffering conditions more ignorance, tends to condition more ignorance. These conditioned pieces of this teaching, ignorance, conditioning mental formations, conditioning consciousness and mind and body and our sense bases and that conditioning that we receive and get impinged on, all of that, The teachings in the suttas around the conditionality, they're different ways these conditions influence each other. And I just want to mention this briefly. So there is this kind of immediacy of in this moment we see something and we have that contact with the eye, and that has a particular feeling to it. And we like that. We like a pleasant feeling. We want to move towards a pleasant feeling. So there's an immediacy to some of these links. And to some of the links, which I'll talk about a little bit more later, there's kind of more, there is some immediacy to it. It's like how we are, you know, the ignorance that's present in this moment is conditioning that we are tumbling forward in this pattern. But also, you know, things that have happened in our distant past, like the way things happened when we were a child on the playground. Something, you know, might have happened on the playground that basically, you know, it does come into this present moment perhaps by a memory in the present moment. But there are ways in which our past conditions our experience now too. And this teaching includes both perspectives. It's not simply about just this moment, you know, this immediacy of experience. It also includes a broader perspective that we are also playing out conditioning from our whole lives, even former lives, according to the teachings of the Buddha, and that this conditioning is tumbling forward far into the future as well. And so it's not, this teaching is not just about, you know, a very small thing. It really encompasses the broader aspects of the way our conditioning plays in our lives. And so I'm going to start this exploration with the kind of immediacy of moment-to-moment experience. And I'm not going to start at the traditional beginning of the chain. It traditionally begins with ignorance and then goes on to some of those links of mental formations and consciousness and mind and body processes. And that, I find, is some of the hardest part of this chain to understand. And so I'm going to start where it's the easiest to understand and take us from there. And the easiest place for us to understand this is, like, we got minds and bodies. We all know that, right? Here we are, we're sitting, we've got minds and bodies. We've got these eyes and ears and nose. We've got a body, and we've got these sense bases. And having these bodies and sense bases, and because there is consciousness, I mean, if we just had a body, if we were a cadaver, there's a body, but there's no consciousness in a cadaver. And so a cadaver doesn't get impinged on. The senses are not impinged on. And so because we are conscious beings, we are receiving sense impressions. Sights come to the eye, sounds come to the ear, smells to the nose, taste to the tongue, contact to the body, and the mind experiences thoughts, emotions, feelings. So we have this impingement. This is the link between, we have these six sense bases. These six sense bases condition contact with the world. So this is a kind of an inner-outer experience here. We are connected to the world through our sense bases. In fact, that's the only way we're connected with the world, is through the input that our senses receive from the world. And so we get these experiences. Every single we are barraged by sense impressions. And whether we're aware of it or not, every single moment of sense experience has a flavor to it. It's got a flavor or a spin of being either pleasant or unpleasant, or neither pleasant nor unpleasant. Much of our sense impressions are kind of in this neither pleasant nor unpleasant or neutral realm. I mean, it's like when I look out at this room, most of the sight is really neutral. You know, the beige sound screens and the walls and the carpet. It's like so much of the site is neutral. Now, I may have some views or ideas about beige. Maybe I don't like beige because I was stuck in a beige classroom when I was a kid or something. I'll talk about that later. But so largely we are impinged, and a lot of what comes in is neutral, but there's a lot of pleasant and unpleasant too. And when our sense impressions are pleasant, so this is the next link in the chain, sense bases, condition, contact, which is those impressions, contact, when there's the contact, every contact has some kind of feeling to it. So we are not only being impinged on by these sights and sounds and smells and tastes and touch, but our system is also at a very deep and subtle level, also processing every single bit of, ooh, this one's pleasant, I like that one. Ooh, this one's pleasant, unpleasant, I don't like that one. So our minds are taking in the pleasant and unpleasant and neutral aspect of experience also. So that's the next link in the chain. And in a very simple way, based on that feeling, almost hardwired, but not hardwired fortunately, based on that feeling, you know, this is almost in an amoeba-like way, we gravitate towards pleasant experience and we want to pull away from unpleasant experience. It's a very natural process. It's a life process, actually. It's not just a human thing. I mean, as I said, an amoeba will kind of move towards nourishment and away from noxious chemicals. You know, so there's a kind of a way in which life gravitates towards what is nourishing and supportive and away from what is harmful to life. And so that tends to be translated into pleasant and unpleasant. And we tend to gravitate and move towards the pleasant and away from the unpleasant in a very natural way. So in this way, we gravitate towards the pleasant, away from the unpleasant, and this is where the next link begins to play out. This is where craving comes into play. Something's pleasant, we want it. We want to get it. We want to have it. We want more of it. Something's unpleasant, we don't want it. We want to get rid of it. We want to push it away. And so this is just describing kind of the function of our minds, how our minds function in a very, human way. It sometimes almost feels like that gravitation towards pleasant is something that we don't have control over. Or the movement away from unpleasant is something we don't have control over. But actually, in our human minds, there's a kind of a, unfortunately, in our human minds, there's a kind of we are able to know something is pleasant and not need to go after it. We are able to know something is unpleasant and not need to get rid of it. But that's not our habitual way of relating to pleasant and unpleasant. And so this is talking about the habitual uninformed way that we, as human beings, tend to be put together. Moving towards pleasant, moving away from unpleasant. So that's the next link in the chain. Feeling tone. This pleasant, unpleasant, neutral aspect of experience tends to condition wanting. We want pleasant. We want to get rid of unpleasant. That wanting conditions a doing something about it. So we want something pleasant, and so we kind of begin to get motivated to act to get that thing. This is the next link in the chain, actually. It's the movement from craving to clinging. It's like the shift between, so we've got our the pleasant thing out there. We want this pleasant thing. And these pleasant things can be sense pleasures, like, a piece of chocolate or a nice meal. But they can also be more deep kind of wishes of our lives. And so, for instance, we might want to have the pleasure of having somebody admire us or give us positive feedback. And so the wanting for being seen or being mirrored or being loved, that there's the kind of movement also towards the wishes for states of being. This is not just about sense pleasure. It's also about wanting particular, in a way, states of being. So we have this movement for wanting, and because of that movement towards wanting, we try to get the thing. So there's that reaching out towards. One teacher described the kind of distinction or the I really think of the craving and clinging. They're just like they're gradations of a similar energy. One teacher described that the craving is kind of like a thief, as they are reaching out to steal something, and the clinging is when they've picked it up. So it's the gradation. When you pick it up, there's a little bit of an intensification of that that energy. So there's the craving that leads to clinging. Once we've clung to something, there's a kind of a movement of our mind that says, okay, this thing, I have to figure out how to keep this thing. It could get taken away from me at any moment. And so there's a kind of a set of patterns and intentions and actions that kind of come together to serve this thing. It's like I've got this thing in my hand. How do I keep it in my hand? This is becoming these intentions and actions that kind of rally in the service of clinging. So we have this. It's a kind of a behavior and intentional process that serves this whole kind of movement from having something pleasant to wanting to getting it. This idea or the sense of becoming, that word, it's kind of like the movement in the direction of, okay, I know how to be in control of this situation. That's kind of the essence to me of this feeling of becoming. It feels like we've figured out how to control things. It feels like we've figured it out. It's like, yeah, this is the way. This is going to do it for me. So we like this feeling of becoming. This feels good. It feels like we know where we're headed. It feels like we know how we're going to keep things, how we're going to get there. So there's that movement towards, okay, this is how I'm going to get to keep this thing, or this is how I'm going to control the situation. And from there, that pattern leads to a kind of an intensification to a full-blown identity. I am the person who's in control of this. So this is a kind of an intensification too. It's moved from being, this is how I'm going to do it, to this is who I am. So we've kind of locked down on those patterns, those intentions. Like, okay, this is how I'm going to do it. And from here, so this is birth. This is the link called birth. We've taken birth into an identity. I am the one who is in control of this. And from here, well, actually earlier on too, you know, suffering is inevitable. Once we have taken birth, actually once we've clung to something, there's an inevitable suffering that's going to happen when we're separated from it, which is inevitable because there's no way we can permanently cling to something. So there's a suffering that will happen around the loss of that having. And then there's additional suffering that happens around the identity that goes, oh my gosh, I'm a failure because I didn't keep that thing. And that's the identity that's been born in the service of that having that thing. So let me just go through a kind of an example. I'm going to do a kind of a more complex example. The easy example, I mean, the simple example is you know, just that there's something pleasant that happens, some sense pleasure that happens when there's something pleasant that happens. Like we see a Starbucks and we think about a latte. So the contact there is really the idea of a latte. And that's pleasant. And then the mind goes, okay, so I want that latte. It's not even right in front of us, but the idea was born, and there's that the pleasure of the contact of that idea, and so the mind creates a set of intentions to get that thing. We drive into the Starbucks, we actually get the thing in our hand. And so there's probably some pleasure around the latte. I've certainly experienced many cups of pleasure. And yet, it's not a very reliable pleasure. The suffering around this kind of sense pleasure is stronger or weaker depending on the intensity of the identification around that particular experience. So I'm not terribly identified with having cups of latte. But that pattern, the pattern of getting something pleasant, and then basically, you know, it lasts for only a certain length of time, that pleasure. You know, it goes away. And then there's a kind of a feeling of bereftness of, I really felt happier when I had something in my hand that I enjoyed. So where else can I get a hit of enjoyment? So we get caught. We get caught on this cycle. So another a kind of maybe more complicated example is like one of those life state examples. Maybe you know, having the idea, the contact with the sense door might be the idea that we need to be seen as a skillful worker in our workplace. We need to be seen as a good worker. And so there's that idea in our mind. That's the contact. And then there's the feeling of pleasure about being in our minds, thinking about, okay, yes, that is a good thing. That's where I want to go. So there's the idea of being a good worker, being perhaps praised as a good worker. And so that pleasure might result to have that desire become a reality. And so, you know, we begin to cling to, there's the desire to be seen as a good worker. And so there's the clinging to that desire is kind of an intensification of it. It's like, so there's the wish to be seen as a good worker. That's not in and of itself a problem, right? It's like that can lead to a kind of a wholesome engagement with the world. And yet, the intensification of that wish might look something like, a fixed attitude that in order to be happy, I have to have my boss praise me every day. And so we that's the clinging. That's the intensification of that wanting. And so then we might start having patterns, stepping into actions. Okay, how am I going to make this happen? How am I going to get my boss to praise me every day? And we start thinking about ways to act, ways to be. So the intentions are born. That's the becoming. This notion of, okay, here's what I can do. I can make sure that I submit these reports every day and that make sure my boss knows that I'm doing things right on time. And so all of these actions to make sure that we get that praise. And then an intensification of it, for simplicity's sake, let's say, we do get the praise regularly. Our boss likes our work and tells us regularly. So this behavior leads to some kind of success in our lives, a feeling that, yes, I am this person who is praised by my boss. So that feels pretty good. That feels pretty good. But unfortunately, that is inevitably not sustainable. Something will happen that is out of our control. Something will happen where we cannot either affect all of those intentions and actions to make sure we get what we want. Or our boss has a bad day and doesn't like say anything to us that day, whether it's related to us or not. It might have nothing to do with us, but when we figure out, what am I doing wrong? How do I? So inevitably, when we really identify around the need for that that praise or that state to be, or that identity to need to be confirmed, that's essentially what this pattern is doing here. It's like this identity, in order to feel okay, needs to keep being confirmed. And if I can't do that myself, I need to have somebody else do it for me. And usually that's a dynamic. That's a dynamic that plays out for a lot of us. We want to be seen. We want to be mirrored. And it is not always possible. And so we suffer when that identity, that need, that strong sense of I'm only okay if is not met. We suffer. I think I see a lot of this happening in out in the, I see this reflected out in our president right now. His need to have that reflection, that need to be seen in a certain way. And the suffering that seems apparent when it's not reflected. So this can be impactful. Not in small ways, not just in small ways, but also when this plays out on the large scale, it can have major consequences. So this kind of cycle is a pattern. It's a pattern for our minds. But it's not the totality of the pattern. As I said, that suffering leads back to the early part of the chain, which we haven't quite talked about yet. And this is where I think it really gets interesting. To me, this first part of the chain that I've talked about, or this section of the chain where we are dealing with our bodies and minds and the sense impressions, this is mostly a description of how our inner processes work. And I think this next part of the chain begins to really point to where does it integrate with the conditioning from the world. So because based on this suffering, based on this, what did I do wrong? How come I'm not getting what I want in this world? That can tend to lead to suffering. It also can lead in another direction. But without an understanding or without an informed, without learning some of the teachings around how we can free ourselves from this pattern, we tend to just get caught back into the pattern. And so when we suffer in this way, we basically tend to double down. It's like, well, okay, I must have done something wrong. Either we blame ourselves or we blame somebody else. Either we blame, you know, it's like, well, I must have done something wrong, so I need to figure out what my control pattern there wasn't quite right. So let me go back and readjust it. And so basically we're moving into the cycle again, just trying to figure out what we did wrong. As opposed to basically recognizing, you know, suffering is the natural consequence of the impermanent and unreliable nature of experience. There's no way we can create a situation where we are in control all the time. And so rather than taking that personally and saying, I failed, it's more like, well, this is the nature. This is the nature of life. This is the nature of experience. We are vulnerable. Suffering happens. We lose things. Sometimes things come into our lives. Sometimes they go away. There's this nature of meeting ends and parting, gain ends and loss. It's just the natural cycle of things. Praise and blame, pleasure and pain. There's these cycles back and forth, these worldly winds. And it's not our fault. It is the nature. And so when we suffer, when we do not have a clear understanding of this pattern, we tend to double down on the pattern. And this is ignorance. It's not understanding the pattern. And so we basically move back into, you know, the thinking the way to be happy. I mean, basically our habit and pattern says the way to be happy is getting what I want, having more pleasure, getting rid of what I don't want, getting rid of that unpleasant. That's what's going to make me happy. That's kind of the basic structure of our habitual mind, and that is reinforced. Our culture reinforces it. Our communities reinforce it. Our families reinforce it. And so we are getting the message over and over again that, yeah, get what you want. That will make you happy. Control the environment. That will make you happy. That's the message we're getting. The message that is shot through our world is imbued with this ignorance, that this is the way to happiness. Now, it does create some little hit of happiness. You know, we get a little hit of happiness when we get something that we want. It lasts for a little while, and then it disappears, because that's the nature of the way pleasure and pain work. They are ephemeral. They come and go quite rapidly. And when we get what we want, have that moment of happiness, we also in that moment, the discomfort of the wanting, the discomfort of the not having, and the feeling of being in control of the becoming, all of that is also happening when we get what we want. And so there's a very powerful reinforcing nature of this. So when we get what we want, we not only get the happiness of having that pleasant thing, but we also get this hit of pleasure of the wanting that goes away, because when something unpleasant goes away, it feels good. So when the wanting goes away, it feels good. When we get what we want, the wanting goes away. When we have that feeling of control, I figured this out, that feels good. And so it really, this cycle really tends to reinforce itself. And yet, this is all informed by a belief that the only way, and we've seen it over and over again in our lives, when I get what I want, I get this moment of happiness, and it feels good to feel like I'm in control. That must be the way. that must be the way to happiness. And so that's a kind of delusion, and that's basically the delusion that's embedded in the belief underlying wanting. Wanting, when we're caught by that wanting, when we're caught by that craving, that belief under there says, yes, the way to happiness is to get that thing. That belief underlying wanting is not going to let us know that if you hang out with wanting, wanting will go away, and the unpleasantness of wanting will go away, and the feeling of needing to have that thing goes away, the dissatisfaction of not having that thing goes away. And so this is a very different approach. But the way that we've lived our lives has only instructed us in get what you want, you'll be happy. Get rid of what you don't want, you'll be happy. And so we don't generally even think of checking out what might happen if we watch from this perspective of mindfulness. Not like, you know, So even in a simple example, like watching the craving around something, a sense pleasure, like having a piece of chocolate, if we watch that wanting instead of following through on it, we might watch that wanting and then, you know, eventually just get distracted by something else. And we notice at some point the wanting has gone away. You know, but it's not really like we've seen the release from that wanting. We can, at times, actually hang out with the wanting. One day I was sitting across from a Starbucks at a traffic light, and the mind created the desire for the latte, and traffic light was a long one, so I got to sit there and watch that for a long time. And I felt the wanting, you know, and I was curious about the wanting. But I was also curious about not following through on the wanting and watching it disappear. So what was going to happen? And what I discovered was that when the light turned green and I turned the corner and did not turn into the Starbucks, it would have been very easy. When I turned that corner and did not turn into the Starbucks, as soon as the Starbucks was out of my field of vision, the wanting released. And I felt it release. It feels like being released from a vice grip. And so this is a completely different way of relating to this feeling tone, relating to these feelings. So this is the kind of understanding that begins to dawn on us. But typically, we don't do that. So ignorance tends to lead to these mental formations of, oh, I need that. I need that that thing. I need that that latte. I need that praise. I need people to believe I'm right. So this is mental formations. This ignorance conditions this desire, this wish for, based on not understanding suffering, our habits and our patterns around how we typically get things that we want, those are what are motivating us. Our beliefs, our views, our opinions. This is the mental formations that is conditioned by ignorance. So our family patterns, our cultures all come into play here, reinforcing these beliefs. And these beliefs inform how we engage in the world. And so at a very powerful level, as we are going through the world, we already have a whole stream of beliefs and views and opinions about what's good, what's bad, what's right, what's wrong. And that's how we're meeting the world. It's kind of like these mental formations are filters through which we are seeing the world. And so, you know, even something, and I'll just go to a quick example here, even something as simple as an agenda can inform how and what we pay attention to. So the basically these mental formations are a whole set of habits and patterns that lead us forward into the choices that we make in our lives. You know, think about who you are in this at this moment in your life, and how that has been shaped by your family, by your education, by our culture. So all of the beliefs, the views, I mean, we have beliefs around how close to stand to somebody when we talk to a stranger. But these kinds of things are not things that are like up in our consciousness. We have, you know, and if we find that people are not engaging in the way that we expect them to, there's a feeling of, ooh, something's off here. And so we have kind of like these shared beliefs through our culture that come into play in the mental formations. And so we carry these filters around with us. Filters, perspectives on pretty much everything. On race, on our relationship to heterosexuality, homosexuality, our relationship to people of different economic classes. We have all kinds of views and opinions around that. And these inform our connection to the world. So we have this the ignorance and all of these influences from our world shaping our minds. And the next link in the chain, these mental formations shape what we're conscious of. Mental formations condition consciousness and how we respond to that with our minds and bodies. And so we tend to, in meeting the world, we are, you know, we're at this point, we're kind of back in the chain where we started. We have a mind and a body, and we're meeting the world and taking in sense impressions. But it's not a neutral, and it's not a neutral kind of robot that's taking this stuff in. It is a very influenced system, influenced by so much conditioning. So I was going to mention, even an agenda can influence what we're conscious of. Even an idea can influence what we take in and what we don't take in. So, you know, if you're focused on something, I was watching a show where there was a magic show. It was about perception, but they were trying to prove a point about perception. And they said, okay, here's a magic trick. See if you can figure out how the magic trick works. So I watched really carefully the magician do the magic trick, very focused on the magician. And maybe I figured out how it worked. I'm not sure, because they never told us that, because that wasn't the point. They asked us, after I'd watched that part, they said, okay, did you see the big guy in a bunny suit walk by? I had not seen the guy in the bunny suit. I had been so focused, I had not been conscious of that. And so this is the way our mental formations shape what we take in. It's like huge sections of our experience are filtered in or filtered out based on these this conditioning, based on all of these conditions and patterns from the television and the internet and our families and our cultures. We take certain things in and we don't take other things in. And so this happens all the time. This is a huge part of our life. And so the shape of our suffering comes not just from, oh, there's something pleasant, I want that. But our whole system has been tuned to look for certain things to be pleasant, to look for other things to get rid of. And so we're coming back to that place of we've got this body and mind and we're receiving sense impressions, but it's not like we're this, you know, camera of eyes and microphones of ears just taking in things. We are very actively filtering things in and out. And this is contributing to the way we tumble forward in this cycle. This is a real an explanation or a pointer in a way to why people tend to read news that confirms their opinions. This is this pattern at work. And so understanding something about this pattern, we can begin to watch it. And we can begin to potentially counter those forces at work. When we begin to recognize this pattern of thinking that if when we begin to expose the belief, having this thing is what's going to do it for me. When we begin to expose that misunderstanding, or, you know, having everybody in the country think I'm the greatest, you know, if that were exposed as a understanding, it would be, these things begin to they begin to fall apart. And this is the benefit of understanding this kind of process, that as we explore our experience, we can bring mindfulness to any place in this process and begin to get curious about it. How does this part of the human experience work? And that begins to undermine this confusion and begins to release us from the pattern. So that's all we have time for. There's a lot more to say, but I hope it was useful. I hope it was supportive to offer this. Thank you for your attention.